Thank you. Our final speaker is Sydney Watts. Sydney is Associate Professor of History and Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies at the University of Richmond, where she also serves as coordinator of the first-year seminar program. She received her PhD from Cornell University, and her first book is Meat Matters, Butchers, Politics, and Market Culture in 18th-century Paris. Her current book project is Lent and Secular Society in Urban France, 1580 to 1840, from which she draws her talk today, Provisioning for Health, Comparing Lenten Butcheries Across 18th Century Urban France. Sydney?
Thank you. And thank you to this panel. I've really benefited from our conversation just last night and certainly thinking more about how consumer society works in all different kinds of ways, but we have incredible overlap in some ways, and it wasn't intentional. Certainly, when I... hopefully it'll spur some good discussion. So I won't take very long, but I just wanted to provide a few examples from this larger project, which really talks... It goes well beyond provisioning for Lent and Lenten butcheries into Lenten practices across three centuries. And a period that often we think about in terms of the rise of secular society and secularization, and that thesis has been challenged in a lot of ways. And so part of this attention to the butchers and certainly those who worked in hospitals to provide meat during Lent for various reasons was something that caught my eye. And today I just want to begin with the premise that the Lenten practice of fasting, which in early modern France meant eating lean, and lean could mean a lot of things, and abstaining from meat, primarily that was the one practice for a Lenten diet, changed in visible ways for the majority of the urban population. I just want to sketch out a few ways of how I'm approaching this question and why. For me, the big question is why these meat-eating consumer habits changed over the long 18th century. It's a difficult one to get at. Consumer behavior is not something that we can easily track, but it's certainly an important one when we're considering the change from goods that are luxury to necessity of needs and wants, and these kinds of questions, I think, permeate in all the presentations today. So I begin with an event. The event is in 1774 when Turgot issued a royal decree dissolving the Lenten ban on meat sales outside of the charity hospitals, what were the Lenten butcheries in Paris, and where Parisians went with either a doctor's prescription or the parish priest's own provision for meat during this 40-day fast. By that time, in 1774, there was a thriving black market in Lenten beef, so much so that the Controller General, in his own proclamation, admitted that this was already beyond the control of the government, and it's not surprising, amidst a number of liberalization efforts, that he would decide to liberate the markets in this way and allow for the free trade of meat during Lent. He certainly recognized the failure of control over this sector of the market. But I think this event also points to a lot of changes in attitude towards meat itself and Lenten provisions that were supplied at hospitals is something that I've discovered across France, across a lot of different regions in different cities, that this provision was something that drew the attention of city leaders and certainly hospitals who provided for the sick, the elderly, nursing mothers, and those that just managed to get that prescription from their doctor for one reason or another. Hospitals performed food therapy for patients who sought meat bouillon as a restorative. Those in medical need could purchase meat even when the butcher shops were forced to close by law. So increasingly, we see these hospitals being outsold by butchers and an illegal traffic of meat during Lent that grows and becomes the concern of these city leaders. So I've argued elsewhere that meat was becoming a good of less of a good of luxury and a religious vice and more of a good of necessity and a healthful benefit, although this is certainly contested by doctors who promote a Lenten diet, in fact. and others who sought the kind of curative powers of bouillon, but certainly not the prodigious meat eating that was happening, particularly to incite the senses and to inflame the sanguine characteristics. It was particularly dangerous for women to do so. So I've explained this, and other historians have explained the shift from luxury to necessity and sort of this rationalization of the marketplace through ideas of the market principle, that the archives are full of, certainly, of regulations and of the top-down concerns of foods of first necessity, and what are those, and how do those get provisioned and distributed and supplied for the people. And meat mattered to those in power as it appeals to one of these primary market principles laid out by Steve Kaplan in his early work on provisioning Paris, where the market principle is really surrounded by what is food security, what is a moral economy, what is a safe and consistent food supply. And certainly Lenten butcheries had to subscribe to that as well, and they operated under this idea of not just the principle, but also the marketplace, and that's another important element of this lens through which we see a lot of studies of food and the food supply, that the marketplace becomes a visible site of exchange, that it is controlled, that it is policed, that the price falls within a moral economy. So Lenten butcheries all followed these rules and became visible and open spaces of exchange, regulated in a circumscribed manner, perhaps more than any market transaction between butchers and their clients, certainly in the black market and outside of the corporate structure. So Paris, of course, you know, is an exception in so many ways. It's an enormous population of people where there is room for an enormous demand and a differentiated demand, I would say, too, that there are places for a lot of people to go and to find different types of meat to suit their needs. What happens when we go to other cities? What happens when we start looking further for comparisons? And so this is where I really begin to think about how in places like Rouen, Caen, Marseille, Lyon, where there were Lenten butcheries, you know, how do we determine this notion of necessity and the differentiation of the market and ideas of supply where there are such large demographic differences, where there are such regional variations, where we are talking about places that had very different relationships to the practice of the Lenten fast. And certainly what's striking here, at least at the first view, is how many similarities we see in the structure of these Lenten butcheries and the need for Lenten meat provisions across France. Certainly a more in-depth comparative study will lead me to determine a lot of the ways in which Lent played a regional part in different parts of France. But already I'm coming across this understanding of Lent as a cultural system tied to not only the materiality of meat itself, but also its symbolic qualities and how differences in the system appear when you compare across public and private health demands, where the food supply really is contingent upon a lot of, as I said, these material and demographic differences. Clearly, breaking the fast is a choice, and one that is personal as much as a collective choice. There were calls for corporate fasts throughout the period of the Reformation among Protestant peoples. There were also corporate fasts during the Revolution among peoples who were not necessarily practicing in the name of the church, but just in the name of sacrifice. And so fasting has a lot of meanings here too. And certainly when we think about the choice of fasting as a choice not to eat meat is pointing to the essence of that symbol itself and the essence of meat itself. Its symbolic and material qualities governs in many cases these choices. Rather than seeing its commodification, I think we need to focus more on the unique characteristics of the commodity, of the thing itself. It's edible. It's taste. It's a transient thing. You put it in your mouth, you chew, you swallow, it's gone. Who sees you do it? Who doesn't see you do it? Is this something that you do in secret? Is it something you do in the open? Certainly, consumerism is, you know, the collection of goods, but this is a very different thing. And like many of our presentations, I think today, a lot of these consumables are into the body. And so that that shift, I think, points me certainly into a lot of other questions. When I think about Lent, not only as a choice for a city to provide something affordable and healthy for its people in preparation for a holiday feast, but also these implicit meanings that are associated with this choice during a 40-day period that focuses on penance and spiritual discipline, a period where there is greater church attendance, a period where there is greater attention to a person's relationship to the divine and how fasting brings people closer to that that power of the divine. So the substance, again, going back to the substance of the lean, is good to think precisely because of its affect on the body. You're weak, you're hungry, you're in fact calling on God in a different way. There's a different effect on the body and the soul. Believers experience the holy fast replete with symbols and rituals in the absence of flesh, in the absence of blood, in an appetite for piety and for austerity, in a temporal plane dictated by a liturgical calendar that separated the days, the lean days, from the fat days. And that seasonality of Lent required preparation and organization in the home and in the markets. Provisions for Lent were necessary to keep the fast and make it a holy time. So we see noble households who, in fact, supplied their fish ponds in preparation for Lent, and other people who markets that were provisioned in the weeks leading up to Lent with salt cod and other preserved fish. There is a sense of seasonality to this. And I think certainly in as much as there is this symbolic and spiritual need that were met by Lenten butcheries, there were, of course, these material needs that drove provisioning. The Lenten diet is fairly specific, at least in the 18th century. And for most people, it consisted of the salted, cured, and sometimes, if you were lucky, a fresh fish. But there were also lentils and beans, and then there was a variety of very exquisite dishes, from truffled fish pâtés to all kinds of tortoise soup. The taxonomy of Lent and the Lenten diet is pretty rich, and when we think about one example, what separates the fat from the lean, it becomes a little bit slippery and a bit ridiculous, perhaps, especially for doctors at the Medical College of Rouen, who deliberated over the fatty tissue and mouthfeel of puffins, an aquatic bird that was abundant to the rocky coast of Normandy. So the problems of taxonomy to distinguish the fish from the fowl, from the amphibious, troubled the upper clergy to no end. But at the same time, there was this sense that the dispensations for the people were given freely, and there was a sense that to relax dietary rules, to allow for eggs, to allow for butter, to allow for milk without much explanation other than to meet the needs of the people, was something that bishops were willing to do. Forward-thinking nobles, certainly with their fish ponds, but also the fishmongers, as I mentioned, with their stockpiles along the northern coasts. Cooks as well, looking through recipe books and finding that section of the cookbook for jour maigre and that kind of cuisine that is going to be the way to prepare ragouts and salads with meat substitutes. It was fashion. It was a fashion of a season, and the economy of Lent moved along with consumer demand. So At this point, you know, we certainly see a turn, though, in the medicalization of the Lenten diet. And in the 18th century, meat, like many food remedies, becomes important year-round as a form of food therapy. And with the marketing of different remedies, meat, bouillon, and different kinds of Lenten diets were being promoted. Meat provisions during Lent become widely available to populations who could claim medical necessity, but also saw it as an individual choice based on their own conditions, based on their own diagnoses, based on what they felt their diet should be. No longer were bishops required to promulgate mass dispensations, nor were parish priests required to communicate these excuses to the Hôtel Dieu. So, you know, we move beyond this 1774 date, we see a real shift where doctors could prescribe meat to their patients, but people could also find that meat for themselves. And at this time, we really do see a shift in a sense of what is a corporate practice to what is an individual practice, that therapeutic individualism that Jones and Spang have discussed in their own work. And what it speaks to me is it certainly in a conversation about what is a good of necessity versus what is a good of luxury is really, I think, integral to this conversation. The medical necessity of meat serves certainly as an indicator among various indices of what we might call de-Christianization, what we might also suggest is a secular society that is changing its attitude towards fasting. Certainly, if we think about this move away from community to society, a Gemeinschaft to a Gesellschaft, that's one way to bifurcate this shift, but I think more helpful is really to see the framing in which it happens, the framing of a secular world, to see this period of change as people experience it in a decline in the public and social authority of the practice of religion, whereby individuals are less inclined to define themselves in terms of their ethical and religious duties. Rather than individualism, we might speak of what Charles Taylor talks about as an age of authenticity, where individuals' sense of freedom and responsibility shape their personal and their moral identities through self-authenticating choices. Thank you.